Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
Well, I'm really privileged to be joined by all of you guys. I'm going to introduce Billy first, Billy Howard. She's the CEO of Brandfro and the founder as well. She has a strategic vision around why customer experience is the new battleground and improved emotional intelligence is the number one catalyst for growth and improved business performance. Billy has a book that I know about, which has been dedicated to the study of the sharing economy called WeCommerce. She's also an active contributor to Fast Company and the Forbes CMO Network, where she instigates conversations with the C-suite to uncover the emerging trends facing the future of marketing, communications, and customer advocacy. And yeah, next I'm going to introduce Diane Gajewski. PhD, and she's a professor and practitioner acknowledged for her expertise in corporate communication, learning, and new technologies. She brings the worlds of higher ed and business through her roles as professor of strategic communication at Ithaca College's Park School of Communications, where she also served as dean for 11 years, and principal at Gajewski Analytics, whose clients include Bank of Montreal, Abbott Diagnostics, US Navy, Ministry of Education of Turkey, and Intel. And you're also the author of 11 books. You're a frequent conference and private workshop leader and named a fellow by the International Association of Business Communicators. And last but not least, Dan Smolin is a former advertising and marketing executive and recruitment specialist who in 2017, similar to me actually, turned to podcasting to discuss pressing issues around career development, the future of work and workplace topics. In the fall of 2022, his podcast, which has been on a brief hiatus, will return as What's Your Work Fit, a live stream program that is driven in part by the active participation of its audience members. Thus, What's Your Work Fit will inform, enlighten, and educate careerists and hiring managers to embrace their work fit, the unique qualities and situations that make the work that they do mission successful and personally meaningful. So yeah, welcome to you guys. I really appreciate you joining me, and I'm going to take my glasses off now because they're kind of steaming up. So it's a little bit warm here, but it's a really interesting space that we're in right now. The future of work, you know, is massive. Everybody, when I first met Billy back in the day, we were doing a little bit of work with IBM, and they were, you know, before Billy joined that program that they were running, I was kind of involved with this AI question of everybody was panicking about AI. And I think a lot of people still are panicking about AI. They still believe this drivel that AI is going to like take over and they're not going to be able to work and it's going to control the world. And, you know, frankly, I think if they haven't been watching, it's kind of already started to control a lot of things that they don't really realize are happening to them. But I've got a lot of questions here. Thankfully, everybody's given me some great questions. And I'm gonna ask Billy first. Can you tell me about the future of work from your point of view? And I think I'm going to ask everybody and we'll go back round and I'll pick a few questions. So what do you think, Billy?
Sure. Well, since everything we do is focused on customer experience and emotion, I think that one of the most critical elements of the future of work will be for leading organizations to understand that their employees are customer number one. In order for anyone to succeed, whether it's in a hybrid work environment or if it's on campus or we ever return to, you know, how things were, which I'm not sure that we will, irregardless, the balance of power has shifted as we've seen it happen over the last decade plus since I originally wrote WeCommerce. It's really all about the many and not the few. And in order for someone to really want to join an organization, even if it's not for their whole career, because we don't see that much longer, a brand needs to emotionally engage with someone to make them want to be a part of that organization. And to do that requires a lot more than, you know, some of the more antiquated means of recruiting, which really focused on function, person, as opposed to really understanding how the entire organization itself needs to emotionally engage with any stakeholder, first and foremost, any employee.
Makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. So, Diane, would you like to share your opinion on the future of work, please?
Well, I certainly agree with everything that Billy has said. I guess one of my interests is kind of looking to the future by looking at the past. And, you know, for millennia, there was a work-life integration. There wasn't this kind of separation between a personal life and a work life. And it's really only in maybe the last 150 years that there has been this complete separation for most people, to the extent that people almost have different personas and different lives, you know, at home or, you know, in their family or among their friends and somebody kind of bringing themselves in a different way to work. I think that's caused all kinds of questions about things like work-life balance and meaning of work. And I guess I think that there will be more integration. The COVID lockdown sort of forced that upon us. And for many people, not in a pretty way, because we were not set up to do that. But I've been interested in that for a long time. As you said in your introduction, along with being a professor, I've run my own consulting company, and I specifically decided to do that through in a wing of my home and to try to integrate those lives in a more conscious way. And it's been an interesting sort of living experiment. So I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but I do think that that's going to be a big driver of what the next experience looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm a big believer in working from home. I've done that for a long, long time. So how about you, Dan? What's your sort of take on the future of work from your perspective?
Well, playing on my friends, Billy and Diane, I'm going to add this. What I hear most often from guests and my listeners is this. How do I make work a part of my day and not the day? And I love that, because for careerists like me, who worked in advertising for many years doing 80-hour weeks, work consumed me, made me successful professionally, but sick physically, mentally, and emotionally. And I think we're at a tipping point here, especially in the wake of the pandemic, where we went through a great awakening, if you will, Nat. People started working from home because they had to, but then they discovered they're working from home because they want to, or they want to a little bit during the day because maybe they have children who play soccer and they never got to see them in a match. And during the day at 3 o'clock, they can take time off, go enjoy their child having a great experience, and then come back to work. Playing on all the things that Diane and Billy have said, I'm going to add this. Our whole sense of time and place are going to be completely changed. Yes, we have all this technology like we're on today that enable us to be anywhere. We can be digital nomads and still do our jobs well. And you're several time zones away from us, and yet we're all together. So this sense of time and place no longer is necessary to do a job. I mentioned that early in my career, I traditionally worked 80-hour weeks. That's no longer a success totem. It's really output. What have you achieved? I hear so much from listeners who say, I want to achieve. I want to do well. I don't hear, I want to work myself into the grave. So all those things are really coming to the fore. And you mentioned my new podcast. You made news today because I haven't really released the name. It's called What's Your Work Fit? And that question came out of a lot of intentional dialogue I've had with friends and PR people who said, what's your work fit? What is it about work that you want to have that's going to make it meaningful, rewarding, but part of a day doing other things? And so as we go on forward, we're going to intentionally ask the questions that our listeners pose to us about work and work fit, what they like to see, but how can they achieve it? So this playground we're in, a future of work, is a very exciting place to be.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's finding that purpose-driven kind of work that you really get a good feeling from, right? And, you know, it's something that I think is becoming more and more important, certainly with recruitment, with companies that are trying to brand themselves, right? They need to get the communication right to actually potential people who are going to work for them, right, at the end of the day. So a quick question for you, Diane. You know, from your experiences with college students, what might surprise corporate leaders about how they need to create effective and inclusive cultures that will attract top talent is a question for you.
Well, I'll give you a recent example. So I was teaching a one credit class for incoming first year students at Ithaca College online. And it's meant to be sort of a soft opening to get them accustomed to taking a college class, get them to start knowing other people, get them to start knowing about Ithaca College, that sort of thing. And there were seven young people in my class. It was all online. And one young man was late with handing in one of his assignments. And so I emailed him and said, you know, can I help you? Are you getting behind? Or, you know, is there something that I can help you with? And he said, can we jump on a private Zoom? And I said, sure. And he started to tell me that he's in the process of getting some of his learning accommodations on file for the upcoming semester. And what he's dealing with is he is diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum. He has ADHD, and he's bipolar. And he's, he's trying to get into the groove of getting back into school and the pressures of moving away to college and getting his meds, and he just had a bad week. That is not unusual. So probably 10 to 20% of students in my class have learning disabilities that are on file and need some sort of accommodation. I would say learning disabilities as well as some physical disabilities. And, you know, we're, that's not unusual. We are a fairly rigorous private school in communications where we have a demanding curriculum, as Billy and Dan can attest, being alums. So we're not a school for special needs people. Now, that said, these students are often among the most high performing. So we can't ignore that that's going to be the talent population that we're going to need to work with as we hire people into teams and organizations. And I think it, from my work in talking to leaders in communications and learning, they're not prepared for this. You know, they're not prepared to offer their training in various kinds of forms. They're also not necessarily aware of a lot of the sort of cultural factors that our students take for granted, such as having preferred pronouns, such as having meals that respect many of the very common needs and preferences of students, such as, you know, more than half of them are vegetarian to start out with, right? So there are little things that are big things to being able to be really inclusive and to try to create environments where these very talented people can succeed despite what were obstacles in a more rigid workplace.
I totally agree with that. You know, we're seeing a lot of that thinking play out, I think, just broadly, because as a society, we're so fatigued. And something that we're seeing in our insights work every day is almost turning Maslow's hierarchy on its head. So instead of leading with function, we're needing to lead with emotion. And I'm not saying that in a self-serving way, because that's what Branthro does. It's just the reality of what's happening. And it's not that one is more important than the other, but, you know, we always used to say we must lead with function and, you know, other needs come after. And ironically, that's actually no longer the case because of the fluidity that our society is experiencing right now, whether it's gender fluidity, cultural fluidity, many different types of fluidity along the lines of other things that Diane mentioned. I think that, you know, shaping the future of work, let alone the future of society, is going to have to completely be upended, you know, almost as a reset button. I think, Dan, you mentioned that the point that we're at, you know, sometimes times of great struggle lead us to the greatest periods in history. I wrote about that and talked about creative destruction in WeCommerce. And I believe that that's what's taking place now. It's a little painful, but hopefully we will get to a better place sooner rather than later.
And I want to add this point to the wonderful points that Billy and Diane made. So Billy studies Gen Z thoroughly. Diane teaches Gen Z. Now, what Diane said, speaking from the frame of accommodations, a typical hiring manager is going to start rolling their eyes. Oh, geez, accommodations. Oh, they're special. Did they get a participation award when they were in middle school? Oh, come on. Gen Z, as a cohort, if you want to typify them with a really positive stereotype, are very ambitious, mission-driven talent. They want to work hard. They want to succeed. They want to make money. So many of them, however, have learning differences. My daughter has all the things that Diane described in her patient, and yet she is a high-functioning, very ambitious young woman. So hiring managers have to understand, you know, you're not hiring people who are used to getting participation awards. This generation coming up are rock stars. They are amazing young people. And they're going to rule the world, and they're going to turn it upside down in a very, very good way. Let's let them. But in order to let them, let's work with their neurodiversity in a way that makes everyone successful.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, with everything that you guys have all just said. It's very interesting, actually, because, you know, this series, as I explained to you before, is basically created because a chap called Pratik is in a wheelchair. He wants to return to the United Kingdom, and he's a penetration tester. He's an ethical hacker, and he works with a one-handed keyboard. And he is one of the most inspiring, hardworking individuals that, you know, that I know in my life. He's 25, 24 years old, and he lives in rural India, but he wants to move back to the UK so he can be self-sufficient. And I was talking to another gentleman, which I'm interviewing soon, and saying, you know, I'd love to just see him learn how to swim. Like, that would just make me feel amazing, right? Because, you know, it's funny how you can sort of spot what these people need, but if you don't tell them what they need, then they don't really think about it, and they may miss an opportunity to do a sport or to do something that they potentially may get joy from, right? Because it's about joy, isn't it? It's about finding areas, in my mind, it's about finding areas in life which you find joy and then bringing that to other areas, you know, and learning comes with that, doesn't it? It's about finding something that you find a childish curiosity that is enlightening, and it recharges your batteries. This whole positivity thing, it's about finding things that you love to do and you really want to learn about, and you would learn about it anyway, even if someone didn't offer to pay you, right? But I speak to loads of people about this stuff. You know, I coach a few people, and some of them are kind of, they're a bit lazy. I'm not being funny. They just sit there and they expect it to just fall into their laps. And I'm like, look, if you want to become an expert in something, you need to sit down and you need to study. And whether you listen to podcasts, watch videos, read books, or a combination of them, of all of those things, or talk to amazing experts like you guys, you need to learn, right? And if you read 100 books in a year, or listen to 50 podcasts, you know, 20 read 20 books and watch whatever amount of videos, you know, you can go to MIT MOOC courses. I'm sure Ithaca probably have loads of free courses that you guys are giving away as well, and Harvard and all these universities globally. It's like there's no real excuse except for, oh, well, I was busy watching a telenovela for my whole life, right? I mean, well, that's my take on it, really, to be honest.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. And I think that that's why you're seeing, as part of, you know, how people are beginning to reimagine work, it's also from the inside out, right? What does the culture look like? And part of what we're seeing is a democratization of thought and a democratization of even the notion of transformation. And what's driving that is, you know, the use actually of insights to empower people to make better decisions. So going back to your earlier point of AI and the threats of it replacing humans, we're now finally at the point of where people are realizing that the latest and greatest data science, AI, machine learning, they're not there to replace anybody. They're designed to empower them to make better decisions that lock into their passions, drive their productivity, and ultimately lead to the best experience both for them and the people that they're serving. And I think that we're going to only continue to see more and more of that thinking come to life.
I did a podcast episode 2 years ago on AI and ML, and it was the highest ranking episode that I've done to date. People are afraid of it, but they're also interested in it. I will tell you, I had major surgery last year that was aided completely by AI and ML. It got me out of the hospital safe, quickly, and without any, any problems whatsoever. We shouldn't fear it. We should embrace it. And from the frame of empowering people who are neurodiverse, imagine the possibility. Somebody who, let's say, is a selective mute, grew up as a selective mute. They're brilliant, but they can't. They lack the ability to converse with people in a normal way, what we would consider a normal way. AI and ML could be a game changer for that person, and not just create a level playing field, create a superpower for them. Now think about that. In the United States, we have active workforces, about 160 million people. 20% or 32 million of them are quote unquote neurodiverse. Actually, Nat, the number is higher, because now you have acquired neurodiverse, people who have had long COVID. Now, one of the effects of long COVID is brain fog, inability to stay in a steadily regulated temperature environment. My daughter gets hot in the summertime cold in the summertime and hot in the wintertime because of a condition that she has, which is very similar to long COVID. She experiences brain fog and temperature differences and an inability to stand up. Sometimes she collapses. More and more of our workforce is going to become what will be acquired neurodiverse, which are people with long COVID. AI and ML will be a game changer for them as well.
Absolutely. I had long COVID actually, and it lasted for about 14, 15 months. And it was what was really strange. After I had a jab, I actually, because I didn't have any jabs until I had COVID. And then I was like, right, I got persuaded by a friend of mine who she's like, look, you have to get your jabs. And so I got them. And within a couple of weeks, I actually started feeling better. And I got rid of long COVID about 2 months later after these two jabs, which was super weird. And since then, I'm almost back to you know, full energy levels, right? But it's terrifying when you do that. But I think you're right. I think that certainly it is with the AI writing tech that's out there, with the way that can be used, it's minimizing the time you need to invest in writing, that you can literally use it, tone of voice, put the tone of voice in there, and you can create some amazing content very quickly. So that's going to help a lot of people, most certainly within that specific space. And that can be used for chatbots. You know, I've said that on a few of these interviews, but it is truly amazing. I mean, I was looking at the WEF and some figures that they were quoting in one of their recent reports, and it's actually amazing when they're basically saying that. Let me see here. that basically global healthcare workforce gap is likely to reach 14.5 million workers by 2030. So if that's not an opportunity for, you know, improving lifestyles, creating robots that can do certain things, but also in parallel, an additional 69 million teachers will need to be recruited in the coming years to reach global education targets. 69 million teachers, right? That's just, it's massive, isn't it, at the end of the day? And that is an opportunity for technology to streamline everything. It isn't just, oh, well, we need all these teachers. It's like, well, okay, sure, you can get some teachers, but if you don't streamline what they're doing, then you're reinventing kind of something that really isn't working, because a lot of it just isn't working, right? Like a lot of people I've heard, you know, they come out of university, they expect everything. They expect a massive job with a huge paycheck and benefits. And it's like, but hold on a minute, this is like your first job, right? Like, how can you kind of expect that, right? You haven't ever worked before, and now you're demanding, you know, 80K, right? And a pension plan and everything. But hold on, you just came out of university. This stuff makes me laugh, right? Like, I was talking to someone about it earlier. It's just funny, you know?
But that demand structure is being broken right now.
Really?
When I got out of school, yeah, I had the same frame. And believe me, my father, who had to pay those college tuition bills, reminded me of that. You better get your butt down to wherever and start working. And I, you know, doing something. Billy will probably know this number better than I, but the average Gen Zer is going to have probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 or in excess of 8 career changes in their lifetime. It may be a dozen. I'm not sure. Billy, maybe you can chime in on that. But that changes the whole paradigm of work to, I've now gotten out of university, and I now have to shape shift to my employer's whims versus I want to figure out who I am, what my unique value proposition is in life, and figure out work that gets me there, but also fulfills my emotional needs, my capital needs, my societal needs, etc. And the latter is where we're going to start heading. With 528,000 new hires last month in the United States, twice as many as is expected. And yet, talent, people who work, are still in the driver's seat and will continue to be, which means they now get to call some of the really important shots about their career. That's a lot of what my podcast is going to be about, helping people figure out what it is that work fit needs to be to make them happy, so that, unlike me, you know, several years into an executive career in advertising, you know, I'm 28 years old and I'm falling to pieces because I'm living everybody else's dreams, not mine. We have a chance here with all the technology you've discovered, with the insight that Billy and Diane are mining and using to really change the lifetime value of work, so that it's talent centered and not output centered or transactional anymore. That's still transactional, but it can't be everything.
Well, nothing can be purely transactional anymore, right?
Right, so right.
The entire shift in the economy from, you know, any brand today doesn't aspire to just transact with you. They aspire to have a relationship with you. It's very much the same in any type of one-to-one situation, work included. So, yeah, I definitely think that we're at a reset point for sure. And it'll be interesting to see how things play out. You know, I'm not so sure that ultimately we'll have 7 or 8 jobs, but maybe we will, maybe they will. I'm not sure that's a good or a bad thing, but we'll see.
Yeah, you know, I think it's very interesting. Oh, sorry, Diane.
You've all mentioned some really interesting things about, you know, the proliferation of content that's free out there, what AI and ML can do, you know, and the aspirations of young college graduates. I mean, one of the things that I know that's driving them, not only their parents, like Dan said, but, you know, they are in deep debt, right? So one of the reasons they're demanding that kind of salary is they have loan payments coming in very quickly. And we see now in the United States that, you know, people are into their 40s before they can buy their first house and start a family, you know, 20 years beyond, you know, what happened in other generations. But I think, you know, we in higher ed are seeing a real upheaval, because the value of a university degree may not be what it was. And there are different ways to learn. And one of the most promising aspects of AI is intelligent tutors, and having something that can, in fact, sort through all that content that's out there and provide it to you in a way that's meaningful, and that you can absorb, and understanding what you already know and your learning styles and what it is that you want to do, and be able to assist you in performing different kinds of jobs. You know, whether people have 4, 5, or 7 careers, I don't even know what a career looks like anymore. Another big trend that I'm seeing is that people have multiple jobs. You know, they have a gig or several gigs and maybe some kind of paid job. But and that's not only because maybe they have to. I was listening to something on NPR yesterday about how many people actually are holding down 2 full-time jobs. But a lot of those are in very low wage positions. But you know, even students who are coming out getting really great jobs don't aspire to do just one thing. So, you know, my son's an example. He's a good writer, so he does content marketing, but he's an art appraiser and has his own practice doing that. And he plays in a number of bands and wants to do that. And I think that's very common of, you know, for students and young people in this new generation. So again, I think even the way that we define a career or job is going to change.
Yeah, very much so. And it's quite exciting, really, if you think about it. I'm really excited about it. I think that people can reinvent themselves and take their transferable skills, and, you know, and I find it just hugely exciting. But I've got a question here for Billy about, or anybody else, if you'd like to discuss it, is why must companies master emotion inside and out to succeed and build the companies of tomorrow? You've talked a bit about it already, Billy, but I'd like to dig a little bit deeper into that, if you don't mind.
Sure. I mean, I think that in order for any business to succeed today, they have to be human led. And that shouldn't just be a buzzword. It needs to be a reality. And in order to be human led, you have to understand how to make people feel in order to get them to act. And that's why a lot of what we've been focusing on at Branthrow lately is helping companies who have all of this copious amounts of data that supposedly lets them know so much about their employees and their customers, when in reality, they don't really know that much because there's hardly any contextualization. So we have focused on building emotional operating systems that help to provide the contextualization, both from an emotional resonance and relevance point of view, so you can really deliver on this promise that we've had hyped, overhyped to the point that it didn't mean anything. Hyper-personalized has meant nothing. And that's because people haven't been able to understand how to close the gap on bringing personalization to scale, which is emotion 100%. So if you're going to be a human-led organization, you're going to pivot, let's say, from talking about broad brush purpose to really diving head forward into this new age of stakeholder capitalism, where everyone has a voice, everyone needs to be emotionally engaged with, and everyone needs to matter. You have to do that inside first before you can do it externally. But once you get in that groove and you have that emotional operating system, there's really nothing that can get in your way, because you have a piece of competitive advantage that no one else will.
And let's talk about the positive ROI of what Billy has done here. You're a company. Do you view hiring as a cost or as an investment? And what Billy has done here is help companies retain talent so that they don't have to replace them as often or as frequently. The talent in the company have a better experience. Their outputs are more meaningful, likely more lucrative for the company and its bottom line. So that's why these things matter.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dan. Thank you for that. We view emotion as a critical KPI. It can be qualitative or it can be quantitative, as Dan just suggested, in things related to retaining employees, acquiring new customers, keeping them loyal, engendering trust, which is absolutely mission critical right now. And you cannot do that with piles of first party, zero party, third party data that are just ones and zeros. You need context to be able to do that. And we've chosen to lean into it. And others are choosing to lean into other things that will hopefully bring more visibility into who people are so that we can engage in more meaningful ways.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I have studied for the past 15 years is the whole idea of intangible assets and how we measure it. And, you know, over the last 30 years or so, it's gone, public companies have gone from intangible assets being an average of 10% of their net worth to being over 90% of their net worth. And so it's work like you're doing, Billy, to be able to kind of quantify that, put it into KPIs, put it into, as you call, an operating system. And Dan, you know, trying to figure out, you know, sort of what is the bottom line of this? You know, it's not just about having happy employees or saying that they're engaged or whatever the latest buzzword is, but it's, you know, what are the hard costs? How do we measure that? And that's obviously what stockholders are interested in. You know, it's the future of the company. And you know, the other thing is that tangible assets can easily be replicated. You know, all you need is some money. Intangible assets usually cannot be replicated. And so, you know, as both of you said, all three of you said, you know, that is the future. That's what's going to be unstoppable in organizations, is to be able to build up those intangible assets of trust, loyalty, knowledge, you know, all those things that are a little squishy right now, but I think organizations are going to find better ways of measuring.
Oh, absolutely.
That sounds epic.
Yeah. I mean, one of my mentors that I've spoken to is one of the top insights professionals in the world. He put a stake in the ground and he said that in the next 3 to 5 years, insights are not going to only be used as vehicles to inform better marketing and things like that. They're actually going to contribute to the market capitalization of an organization. So, you know, to Dan's point, you know, looking at insights tied to a specific use case, like, you know, the future of work and getting the best fit for your talent, having insights to understand what are the right hard skills, what are the right soft skills that go into a position that the person that's going to sit in that role is going to be an entirely, maybe newly imagined person that you might have never thought of before. Maybe it's a brand new role, but that's why I think the work that Dan is doing is so important. In addition to, you know, the things that Diane mentioned, that, you know, there's just so much important work that needs to be done. And this is such an important conversation that we're having, I believe.
Yeah, I'll give you a great example. One of my favorite consulting war stories is I worked for, was a consultant for a company that, that had processed Medicare claims, right? And they called me in and their problem was their desks are too small. And I said, what? And so they said, actually the manuals that these people who were on the phones, who were the customer service reps, had these big manuals. And there were so many manuals, they would not fit on people's desks for the day of everything being online, right? And so, like, so I sat through their training, you know, and it was 16 weeks of training to be able to do day number one of a minimum wage job, to answer the phone and have somebody, you know, ask you the question of, like, why didn't Medicare reimburse my, you know, toenail? And what they were hiring for was typing skills, because these customer service reps had to type in things as people were talking. And of course, they first of all, I could only last through like an hour of their training. And I survived a PhD, right? But I couldn't sit through more than an hour. So they were losing people. And what they needed to do, to Billy's point, is it wasn't whether they could type, it's whether they liked to talk to mostly old people who were rather frustrated and confused because Medicare didn't reimburse something, right? And so what they were hiring then is they actually got people who liked to chat with elderly people, and they also got part-time college students in the area who thought it was kind of fun and were good at figuring out problems. Entirely different than somebody who is a fast typist.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
If
wow.
you lasted wow. for only an hour, how long would I have lasted?
5 minutes, Billy, knowing you. 5 minutes on that one. So, Dan, I've got a question yes. for you, because you've answered a lot of what I was going to ask you, like everybody has, which is great. But I like to keep checking just to make sure I don't kind of miss anything, right? So you drive thought leadership around the future of work and workplace issues. What are some of the issues and trends that really stand out? I know you've talked a little bit about those, but feel free to kind of elaborate, and we'll kick that off, I think.
So I'll try to keep this real time. Yesterday on LinkedIn, I put out a post really to get people talking about the things that are bothering them. And the biggest one of all was ageism. That surprised me. I would have thought something around quote unquote work-life balance. But from both the younger end of the workplace to the oldest end of the workplace, people are concerned about ageism. I heard from young folks who were like, I don't think the boss is going to take me seriously because I'm a newbie on the workplace, in the workplace. And of course, older people who have this depth and breadth of knowledge, who find themselves exited out of companies. And by the way, when I was a headhunter, the dirty little secret of ageism was, so-and-so doesn't look like our organization, which was a lot of BS. But ageism, I think, is ranking very high, Nat, in terms of future of work issues right now. And it's a great opportunity. Older people, again, have this wealth of knowledge, institutional knowledge often. And younger people have energy, and they have new ways of fixing problems. Digital natives have a whole new way. I mean, can you imagine a digital native with Diane's client? The first thing they would have done was take out the big lighter and set aflame those bound editions and create something that was more neural network based and got the customer service response person to the right information base so that they could answer that poor older person's problems about their toenail. But ageism is a problem, but it's also an opportunity I think we need to fix. Also neurodiversity. And again, I think with so many people in mainstream media focused on back to work, what they're missing is that we're never really going back to the way things are. And we have this amazing cohort within our working population that remains untapped and woefully under-rewarded, woefully underpaid, woefully under-trained and supported. And so I'm hearing neurodiversity in different frames and also ageism really bubbling up right now. And I don't hear anybody talking about it. I hope to be one of the first to really drive those conversations starting this fall.
Very cool. Look forward to it.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'll be happy to share that for you as well if you let me know when it's out. That'll be very interesting. So, yeah, I mean, I think we've talked massively about, this whole sort of topic. So within, we're going to just sort of finish up in the next 5 minutes. And, within the technology space, right, do you think that there is, this is to Billy, first of all, do you think there is some sort of great future of innovation and employee experience and the soft, hard skills required for success? You've already sort of talked a bit about that. So what do you think about the future of innovation and employee experience?
Well, I think we've touched on a lot of it. I think that it's, in order for innovation to progress at the pace that it's going to need to progress, a lot of the different changes that we've talked about need to happen. The right type of talent needs to happen. The right type of organizational structure needs to happen. And the right approach to, again, democratizing people to make better decisions or make empowering them to make decisions at all is going to bring together diversity of thought. And I think that that has been lacking for decades for many, many reasons. And I think that when all of these different factors potentially come together, we're hopefully going to see a much more robust approach to innovation that's not just designed to, you know, meet the bottom line requirements of a corporation, but hopefully also have an aspiration to help us all come together and really make the world a better place. And do so this time in a much more meaningful way than perhaps the last era of purpose and where those things fell down.
Absolutely. I agree absolutely completely with that. It's, you know, when mechanization arrived and, you know, we went through the Industrial Revolution, everyone was promised this dream, right? It's like, hey, don't worry, you know, you're going to have a tractor here and don't you worry, you won't have to work very hard. But what actually happened? Like, and we've been sold this dream. I personally think we're still in that, right? And some of the people who actually get to grips with using the tech instead of letting the tech use them, and I mean that in a way of, you know, if we've all watched The Social Dilemma, we all know about how technology is affecting our brains, how we're, you know, totally addicted to notifications, to screens, to all of these things. And if we let that technology to continue to control us, then we've got issues. But I think there are going to be a lot of people who just say, you know, there's more to life than sitting there behind a screen. And actually, I want to enjoy my life and have a balance. Not balance, integration is. So I agree with what Dan's saying about that, what all of you guys are saying. The integration is massive, you know. So what do you guys kind of think? Dan, what do you think on this one?
You know, you brought up the last Industrial Revolution when we pulled talent out of farm and field. And along the way, you know, we got the steady paycheck. That was cool. And it helped build the American dream. And then along the way, we lost our industrial economy and we became a service-based economy in the 70s and 80s. And nobody was making anything anymore. The really cool thing that's happening in the future of work is I think we're going to re-embrace the maker economy. And that chap that you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, Nat, will have technology that either he can make for himself or others can make for him to make his work life more productive, more enjoyable whatsoever. But the maker movement, I think, is going to, that's like I don't hear enough about it. I think we're going to start learning how to make really cool stuff. Maybe not on a grand industrial scale like they did pumping cars out of Detroit, you know, through most of the 20th century. But on a meaningful scale, I think we're going to start making things again. And when we do that, I think we're going to tap a joyful experience in the workplace. You know, more people are going to want to work to build things, to make things. And it's not just going to be about servicing somebody else's need or answering the phone in that telecenter where Diane had to suffer with the manuals. So
absolutely.
I'm really very excited and really looking forward to all the innovation that's going to come down the line in the next year, in the next 10, and the next 20. And for the rest of my life, for sure.
Super. Is there anything briefly you'd like to add to that, Diane?
I will add briefly that I think along with a maker space, maker idea, we're going to be growing our own food. I see much more interest in sustainability and locally grown food. And a lot of the technology, including AI, enables people to successfully grow their own food in both an urban and suburban environments. And, you know, that's, I think, another way of integrating one's life.
Super. Well, thank you all so much.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.